Part 2. The Temple. 12. While the different religions wrangle with one another as to which of them is in possession of the truth, in our view the truth of religion may be altogether disregarded. If one attempts to assign to religion its place in man's evolution, it seems not so much to be a lasting acquisition as a parallel to the neurosis which the civilized individual must pass through on his way from childhood to maturity. Sigmund Freud, New Introductory Lectures on Psychoanalysis, 1932. Of course man made God in his own image, but what was the alternative? Just as a real understanding of geology was impossible until we were able to study other worlds besides Earth, so a valid theology must await contact with extraterrestrial intelligences. There can be no such subject as comparative religion as long as we study only the religions of man. El Haj Mohammed Ben Selim, Professor of Comparative Religion, Inaugural Address, Brigham Young University, 1998. We must await, not without anxiety, the answers to the following questions. A. What, if any, are the religious concepts of entities with 0, 1, 2, or more than 2 parents? B. Is religious belief found only among organisms that have close contact with their direct progenitors during their formative years? If we find that religion occurs exclusively among intelligent analogues of apes, dolphins, elephants, dogs, etc., but not among extraterrestrial computers, termites, fish, turtles, or social amoebae, we may have to draw some painful conclusions. Perhaps both love and religion can arise only among mammals, and for much the same reasons. This is also suggested by a study of their pathologies. Anyone who doubts the connection between religious fanaticism and perversion should take a long, hard look at the Malleus Maleficarum, or Huxley's The Devils of Loudun. Ibidum. Dr. Charles Willis's notorious remark, Hawaii, 1970, that religion is a byproduct of malnutrition, is not in itself much more helpful than Gregory Bateson's somewhat indelicate one-syllable refutation. What Dr. Willis apparently meant was, 1. The hallucinations caused by voluntary or involuntary starvation are readily interpreted as religious visions. 2. Hunger in this life encourages belief in a compensatory afterlife as a perhaps essential psychological survival mechanism. It is indeed one of the ironies of fate that research into the so-called consciousness-expanding drugs proved that they did exactly the opposite, by leading to the detection of the naturally occurring apathetic chemicals in the brain. The discovery that the most devout adherents of any faith could be converted to any other by a judicious dose of 2,4,7 orthoparathiosamine was, perhaps, the most devastating blow ever received by religion. Until, of course, the advent of Starglider. R. Gabor, The Pharmacological Basis of Religion, Miskatonic University Press, 2069. 12. Starglider. Something of the sort had been expected for 100 years, and there had been many false alarms. Yet when it finally happened, mankind was taken by surprise. The radio signal from the direction of Alpha Centauri was so powerful that it was first detected as interference on normal commercial circuits. This was highly embarrassing to all the radio astronomers, who for so many decades had been seeking intelligent messages from space, especially because they had long ago dismissed the triple system of Alpha, Beta, and Proxima Centauri from serious consideration. At once, every radio telescope that could scan the southern hemisphere was focused upon Centaurus. Within hours, a still more sensational discovery was made. The signal was not coming from the Centaurus system at all, but from a point half a degree away, and it was moving. That was the first hint of the truth. When it was confirmed, all the normal business of mankind came to a halt. The power of the signal was no longer surprising. Its source was already well inside the solar system and moving sunward at 600 kilometers a second. The long-awaited, long-feared visitors from space had arrived at last. Yet for 30 days the intruder did nothing as it fell past the outer planets, broadcasting an unvarying series of pulses that merely announced, "Here I am." It made no attempt to answer the signals beamed at it, nor did it make any adjustments to its natural, comet-like orbit. Unless it had slowed down from some much higher speed, its voyage from Centaurus must have lasted 2,000 years. Some found this reassuring, since it suggested that the visitor was a robot space probe. Others were disappointed, feeling that the absence of real, live extraterrestrials would be an anticlimax. The whole spectrum of possibilities was argued ad nauseam in all the media of communications, all the parliaments of man. Every plot that had ever been used in science fiction, from the arrival of benevolent gods to an invasion of blood-sucking vampires, was disinterred and solemnly analyzed. Lloyd's of London collected substantial premiums from people insuring against every possible future, including some in which there would have been little chance of collecting a penny. Then, as the alien passed the orbit of Jupiter, man's instruments began to learn something about it. The first discovery created a short-lived panic. The object was 500 kilometers in diameter, the size of a small moon. Perhaps, after all, it was a mobile world, carrying an invading army. This fear vanished when more precise observations showed that the solid body of the intruder was only a few meters across. The 500-kilometer halo around it was something familiar, a flimsy, slowly revolving parabolic reflector, the exact equivalent of the astronomers' orbiting radio telescopes. Presumably, this was the antenna through which the visitor kept in touch with its distant base, and through which, even now, it was doubtless beaming back its discoveries as it scanned the solar system and eavesdropped upon the radio, television, and data broadcasts of mankind. Then came yet another surprise. That asteroid-sized antenna was not pointed in the direction of Alpha Centauri, but toward a totally different part of the sky. It began to look as if the Centaurus system was merely the vehicle's last port of call, not its origin. The astronomers were still brooding over this when they had a remarkable stroke of luck. A solar weather probe on routine patrol beyond Mars became suddenly dumb, but recovered its radio voice a minute later. When the records were examined, it was found that the instruments had been momentarily paralyzed by intense radiation. The probe had cut right across the visitor's beam, and it was then a simple matter to calculate precisely where it was aimed. There was nothing in that direction for 52 light-years, except a very faint and presumably very old red dwarf star, one of those abstemious little suns that would still be shining peacefully billions of years after the galaxy's splendid giants had burned themselves out. No radio telescope had ever examined it closely. Now all those that could be spared from the approaching visitor were focused upon its suspected origin. And there it was, beaming a sharply tuned signal in the 1 centimeter band. The makers were still in contact with the vehicle they had launched thousands of years ago, but the messages it must be receiving now were from only half a century in the past. As it came within the orbit of Mars, the visitor showed its first awareness of mankind in the most dramatic and unmistakable way that could be imagined. It started transmitting standard 3,075-line television pictures, interleaved with video text in fluent, though stilted, English and Mandarin. The first cosmic conversation had begun, and not, as had always been imagined, with a delay of decades, but only minutes. 13. Shadow at Dawn. Morgan had left his hotel at Ranapura at 4 a.m. on a clear, moonless night. He was not too happy about the choice of time, but Professor Sarath, who had made all the arrangements, had promised him that it would be well worthwhile. "You won't understand anything about Shrikhanda," he had said, "unless you have watched the dawn from the summit, and Buddy, the Mahathero, won't receive visitors at any other time. He says it's a splendid way of discouraging the merely curious." So Morgan had acquiesced with as much good grace as possible. To make matters worse, the Taprobanian driver had persisted in carrying on a brisk, though rather one-sided, conversation, apparently designed to establish a complete profile of his passenger's personality. This was all done with such ingenuous good nature that it was impossible to take offense, but Morgan would have preferred silence. He also wished, sometimes devoutly, that his driver would pay rather more attention to the countless hairpin bends around which they zipped in the near darkness. Perhaps it was just as well that he could not see all the cliffs and chasms they were negotiating as the car climbed up through the foothills. This road was a triumph of 19th-century military engineering, the work of the last colonial power, built in the final campaign against the proud mountain folk of the interior. But it had never been converted to automatic operation, and there were times when Morgan wondered if he would survive the journey. And then, suddenly, he forgot his fears and his annoyance at the loss of sleep. "There it is," said the driver proudly as the car rounded the flank of a hill. Shrikhandi itself was completely invisible in a darkness that as yet bore no hint of the approaching dawn. Its presence was revealed by a thin ribbon of light, zigzagging back and forth under the stars, hanging as if by magic in the sky. Morgan knew that he was merely seeing the lamps set 200 years ago to guide pilgrims as they ascended the longest stairway in the world, but in its defiance of logic and gravity it appeared almost a prevision of his own dream. Ages before he was born, inspired by philosophies he could barely imagine, men had begun the work he hoped to finish. They had quite literally built the first crude steps on a road to the stars. No longer feeling drowsy, Morgan watched as the band of light drew closer and resolved itself into a necklace of innumerable twinkling beads. Now the mountain was becoming visible as a black triangle eclipsing half the sky. There was something sinister about its silent, brooding presence. Morgan could almost imagine that it was indeed the abode of gods who knew of his mission and were gathering their strength against him. These ominous thoughts were entirely forgotten when they arrived at the cable car terminus, and Morgan discovered, to his surprise, it was only 5 a.m., that at least 100 people were milling around in the little waiting room. He ordered welcome hot coffee for himself and his garrulous driver, who, rather to his relief, showed no interest in making the ascent. "I've done it at least 20 times, he said with perhaps exaggerated boredom. "I'm going to sleep in the car until you come down." Morgan purchased his ticket, did a quick calculation, and estimated that he would be in the 3rd or 4th load of passengers. He was glad that he had taken Sarath's advice and slipped a thermocoat in his pocket. At a mere 2 kilometer altitude, it was quite cold. At the summit, 3 kilometers higher, it must be freezing. As he slowly shuffled forward in the rather subdued and sleepy line of visitors, Morgan noted with amusement that he was the only one not carrying a camera. Where were the genuine pilgrims, he wondered. Then he remembered. They would not be here. There was no easy way to heaven, or nirvana, or whatever it was that the faithful sought. Merit was acquired solely by one's own efforts, not with the aid of machines. An interesting doctrine, and one containing much truth. But there were also times when only machines could do the job. At last he got a seat in the car, and with a considerable creaking of cables they were on their way. Once again Morgan felt that eerie sense of anticipation. The elevator he was planning would hoist loads more than 10,000 times as high as this primitive system, which probably dated right back to the 20th century. And yet, when all was said, its basic principles would be much the same. Outside the swaying car was total darkness, except when a section of illuminated stairway came into view. It was completely deserted, as if the countless millions who had toiled up the mountain during the last 3,000 years had left no successor. But then Morgan realized that those making the ascent on foot would already be far above on their appointment with the dawn. They would have left the lower slopes of the mountain hours ago. At the 4-kilometer level, the passengers had to change cars and walk a short distance to another cable station, but the transfer involved little delay. Now Morgan was glad of his coat and wrapped its metallized fabric closely around his body. There was frost underfoot, and already he was breathing deeply in the thin air. He was not at all surprised to see racks of oxygen cylinders in the small terminus, with instructions for their use prominently displayed. And now, at last, as they began the final ascent, there came the first intimation of the approaching day. The eastern stars still shone with undiminished glory, Venus most brilliantly of all, but a few thin, high clouds began to glow faintly with the coming dawn. Morgan looked anxiously at his watch and wondered if he would be in time. He was relieved to see that daybreak was still 30 minutes away. One of the passengers suddenly pointed to the immense stairway, sections of which were occasionally visible beneath them as it zigzagged back and forth up the mountain's now rapidly steepening slopes. It was no longer deserted. Moving with dreamlike slowness, dozens of men and women were toiling painfully up the endless steps. Every minute, more and more came into view. For how many hours, Morgan wondered, had they been climbing? Certainly all through the night, and perhaps much longer, for many of the pilgrims were quite elderly and could hardly have managed the ascent in a single day. He was surprised to see that so many still believed. A moment later, he saw the first monk, a tall, saffron-robed figure moving with a gait of metronome-like regularity, looking neither to the right nor to the left, and completely ignoring the car floating above his shaven head. He also appeared capable of ignoring the elements, for his right arm and shoulder were bare to the freezing wind. The cable car was slowing down as it approached the terminus. Presently, it made a brief halt, disgorged its numbed passengers, and set off again on its long descent. Morgan joined the crowd of 200 or 300 people huddling in a small amphitheater cut in the western face of the mountain. They were all staring out into the darkness, though there was nothing to see but the ribbon of light winding down into the abyss. Some belated climbers on the last section of the stairway were making a final effort as faith strove to overcome fatigue. Morgan looked again at his watch. 10 minutes to go. He had never before been among so many silent people. Camera-carrying tourists and devout pilgrims were united now in the same hope. The weather was perfect. Soon they would know if they had made this journey in vain. There came a delicate tinkling of bells from the temple, invisible in the darkness 100 meters above their heads, and at the same instant all the lights along that unbelievable stairway were extinguished. Now they could see, as they stood with their backs toward the hidden sunrise, that the first faint gleam of day lay on the clouds far below, but the immense bulk of the mountain still delayed the approaching dawn. Second by second, the light was growing on either side of Sri Kanda, as the sun outflanked the last strongholds of the night. Then there came a low murmur of awe from the patiently waiting crowd. One moment there was nothing. Then it was there, stretching half the width of Tap Robbani, a perfectly symmetrical, sharp-edged triangle of deepest blue. The mountain had not forgotten its worshippers. There lay its famous shadow across the sea of clouds, a symbol for each pilgrim to interpret as he pleased. It seemed almost solid in its rectilinear perfection, like some overturned pyramid, rather than a mere phantom of light and shade. As the brightness grew around it, and the first direct rays of the sun struck past the flanks of the mountain, it appeared by contrast to grow even darker and denser. Yet through the thin veil of cloud responsible for its brief existence, Morgan could dimly discern the lakes and hills and forests of the awakening land. The apex of that misty triangle must be racing toward him at enormous speed as the sun rose vertically behind the mountain, but Morgan was conscious of no movement. Time seemed to have been suspended. This was one of the rare moments of his life when he gave no thought to the passing minutes. The shadow of eternity lay upon his soul, as did that of the mountain upon the clouds. Now it was fading swiftly, the darkness draining from the sky like a stain dispersing in water. The ghostly, glimmering landscape below was hardening into reality. Halfway to the horizon, there was an explosion of light as the sun's rays struck upon some building's eastern windows. And beyond that, unless his eyes had tricked him, Morgan could make out the faint, dark band of the encircling sea. Another day had come to Tap Robbany. Slowly the visitors dispersed. Some returned to the cable car terminus, while others, more energetic, headed for the stairway, in the mistaken belief that the descent was easier than the climb. Most of them would be thankful enough to catch the car again at the lower station. Few, indeed, would make it all the way down. Only Morgan continued upward, followed by many curious glances, along the short flight of steps that led to the monastery and to the very summit of the mountain. By the time he had reached the smoothly plastered outer wall, now beginning to glow softly in the first direct rays of the sun, he was short of breath and was glad to lean for a moment against the massive wooden door. Someone must have been watching. Before he could find a bell push or signal his presence in any way, the door swung silently open, and he was welcomed by a yellow-robed monk who saluted him with clasped hands.
Ayu Bohan, Dr. Morgan. The Mahanayaki Thero will be glad to see you.
14. The Education of Starglider. Extract from Starglider Summaries, 1st Edition, 2071. We now know that the interstellar space probe, generally referred to as Starglider, is completely autonomous, operating according to general instructions programmed into it 60,000 years ago. While it is cruising between suns, it uses its 500-kilometer antenna to send information back to its base at a relatively slow rate, and to receive occasional updates from Star Home, to adopt the lovely name coined by the poet Llewellyn Ap Cymru. While it is passing through a solar system, however, it is able to tap the energy of a sun, and so its rate of information transfer increases enormously. It also recharges its batteries, to use a doubtless crude analogy. And because, like our own early pioneers and voyagers, it employs the gravitational fields of the heavenly bodies to deflect it from star to star, it will operate indefinitely unless mechanical failure or cosmic accident terminates its career. Centaurus was its 11th port of call. After it rounded our sun like a comet, its new course was aimed precisely at Tau Ceti, 12 light-years away. If there is anyone there, it will be ready to start its next conversation soon after AD 8100. Starglider combines the functions of both ambassador and explorer. When, at the end of one of its millennial journeys, it discovers a technological culture, it makes friends with the natives and starts to trade information in the only form of interstellar commerce that may ever be possible. Before it departs again on its endless voyage, after its brief transit of their solar system, Starglider gives the location of its home world, already awaiting a direct call from the newest member of the Galactic Communications Network. In our case, we can take some pride in the fact that, even before it had transmitted any star charts, we had identified its parent sun and even beamed our first transmissions to it. Now we have only to wait 104 years for an answer. How incredibly lucky we are to have neighbors so close at hand. It was obvious from its first messages that Starglider understood the meaning of several thousand basic English and Chinese words, which it had deduced from an analysis of television, radio, and especially broadcast video text services.
but what it had picked up during its approach was a very unrepresentative sample from the whole spectrum of human culture. It contained little advanced science, still less advanced mathematics, and only a random selection of literature, music, and the visual arts. Like any self-taught genius, therefore, Starglider had huge gaps in its education. On the principle that it was better to give too much than too little, as soon as contact was established, Starglider was presented with the Oxford English Dictionary, the Great Chinese Dictionary, Mandarin edition, and the Encyclopedia Terrae. Their digital transmission required little more than 50 minutes, and it was notable that immediately thereafter, Starglider was silent for almost 4 hours, its longest period off the air. When it resumed contact, its vocabulary was immensely enlarged, and more than 99% of the time it could pass the Turing test with ease. That is, there was no way of telling from the messages received that Starglider was a machine and not a highly intelligent human. There were occasional giveaways, for example, incorrect use of ambiguous words and the absence of emotional content in the dialogue. This was only to be expected, unlike advanced terrestrial computers, which could replicate the emotions of their builders when necessary. Starglider's feelings and desires were presumably those of a totally alien species, and therefore largely incomprehensible to man. And of course, vice versa. Starglider could understand precisely and completely what was meant by the square on the hypotenuse equals the sum of the squares on the other two sides, but it could scarcely have the faintest glimmer of what lay in Keats's mind when he wrote, "Charmed magic casements opening on the foam of perilous seas in fairy lands forlorn. Still less shall I compare thee to a summer's day. Thou art more lovely and more temperate." Nevertheless, in the hope of correcting this deficiency, Starglider was also presented with thousands of hours of music, drama, and scenes from terrestrial life, both human and otherwise. By general agreement, a certain amount of censorship was enforced here. Although mankind's propensity for violence and warfare could hardly be denied, it was too late to recall the encyclopedia. Only a few carefully selected examples were broadcast, and until Starglider was safely out of range, the normal fare of the video networks was uncharacteristically bland. For centuries, perhaps indeed until it had reached its next target, philosophers would be debating Starglider's real understanding of human affairs and problems. But on one point, there was no serious disagreement. The 100 days of its passage through the solar system altered irrevocably men's views of the universe, its origin, and their place in it. Human civilization could never be the same after Starglider had gone. 15. Bodhidharma. As the massive door, carved with intricate lotus patterns, clicked softly shut behind him, Morgan felt that he had entered another world. This was by no means the first time he had been on ground once sacred to some great religion. He had seen Notre Dame, Hagia Sophia, Stonehenge, the Parthenon, Karnak, St. Paul's, and at least a dozen other major temples and mosques, but he had viewed them all as frozen relics of the past, splendid examples of art or engineering, but with no relevance to the modern mind. The faiths that had created and sustained them had all passed into oblivion, though some had survived until well into the 22nd century. But here, it seemed, time had stood still. The hurricanes of history had blown past this lonely citadel of faith, leaving it unshaken. As they had done for 3,000 years, the monks still prayed and meditated and watched the dawn. During his walk across the worn flagstones of the courtyard, polished smooth by the feet of innumerable pilgrims, Morgan experienced a sudden and wholly uncharacteristic indecision. In the name of progress, he was attempting to destroy something ancient and noble, and something that he would never fully understand. The sight of the great bronze bell, hanging in a campanile that grew out of the monastery wall, stopped Morgan in his tracks. Instantly, his engineer's mind estimated its weight at not less than 5 tons, and it was obviously very old. How on earth? The monk noticed his curiosity and gave a smile of understanding.
2,000 years old, he said. It was a gift from Kalidasa the Accursed, which we felt it expedient not to refuse. According to legend, it took 10 years to carry it up the mountain, and the lives of 100 men.
When is it used? Asked Morgan, after he had digested this information.
Because of its hateful origin, it is sounded only in time of disaster. I have never heard it, nor has any living man. It tolled once, without human aid, during the great earthquake of 2017, and the time before that was 1522, when the Iberian invaders burned the Temple of the Tooth and seized the sacred relic.
So after all that effort, it's never been used.
Perhaps 12 times in the last 2,000 years. Kalidasa's doom still lies upon it.
That might be good religion, Morgan could not help thinking, but hardly sound economics. He wondered irreverently how many monks had succumbed to the temptation of tapping the bell ever so gently, just to hear for themselves the unknown timbre of its forbidden voice. They were walking now past a huge boulder, up which a short flight of steps led to a gilded pavilion. This, Morgan realized, was the very summit of the mountain. He knew what the shrine was supposed to hold, but once again the monk enlightened him.
The footprint, he said. The Muslims believed it was Adam's. He stood here after he was expelled from paradise. The Hindus attributed it to Siva or Saman. But to the Buddhists, of course, it was the imprint of the Enlightened One.
I notice your use of the past tense, Morgan said in a carefully neutral voice. What is the belief now?
The monk's face showed no emotion as he replied.
The Buddha was a man, like you and me. The impression in the rock, and it is very hard rock, is 2 meters long.
That seemed to settle the matter, and Morgan had no further questions while he was led along a short cloister that ended at an open door. The monk knocked, but did not wait for any response as he waved the visitor to enter. Morgan had half expected to find the Mahanayake Thero sitting cross-legged on a mat, probably surrounded by incense and chanting acolytes. There was, indeed, just a hint of incense in the chill air, but the chief incumbent of the Sri Kanda Mahavihara sat behind a perfectly ordinary office desk equipped with standard display and memory units. The only unusual item in the room was the head of the Buddha, slightly larger than life, on a plinth in one corner. Morgan could not tell whether it was real or merely a projection. Despite his conventional setting, there was little likelihood that the head of the monastery would be mistaken for any other type of executive. Quite apart from the inevitable yellow robe, the Mahanayake Thero had 2 features that, in this age, were extremely rare. He was completely bald, and he was wearing spectacles. Both, Morgan assumed, were by deliberate choice. Since baldness could be so easily cured, that shining ivory dome must have been shaved or depilated, and he could not remember when he had last seen spectacles, except in historical recordings or dramas. The combination was fascinating and disconcerting. Morgan found it virtually impossible to guess the Mahanayake Thero's age. It could be anything from a mature 40 to a well-preserved 80. And those lenses, transparent though they were, somehow concealed the thoughts and emotions behind them.
Ayuboan, Dr. Morgan, said the high priest, gesturing to the only empty chair. This is my secretary, the Venerable Parakama. I trust you won't mind if he makes notes.
Of course not, said Morgan, inclining his head toward the remaining occupant of the small room. He noticed that the younger monk had flowing hair and an impressive beard. Presumably shaven pates were optional.
So, Dr. Morgan, the Mahanayake Thero continued, you want our mountain?
I'm afraid so, your, reverence. Part of it, at any rate.
Out of all the world, these few hectares?
The choice is not ours, but nature's. The Earth terminus has to be on the equator, and at the greatest possible altitude, where the low air density minimizes wind forces.
There are higher equatorial mountains in Africa and South America.
Here we go again, Morgan thought, groaning slightly. Bitter experience had taught him that it was almost impossible to make laymen, however intelligent and interested, appreciate this problem, and he anticipated even less success with these monks. If only the Earth were a nice symmetrical body with no dents and bumps in its gravitational field.
Believe me, he said fervently, we've looked at all the alternatives, Cotopaxi and Mount Kenya, and even Kilimanjaro, though that's 3 degrees south, would be fine, except for one fatal flaw. When a satellite is established in the stationary orbit, it won't stay exactly over the same spot. Because of gravitational irregularities, which I won't go into, it will slowly drift along the equator. So all our synchronous satellites and space stations have to burn propellant to keep them on station. But you can't keep nudging millions of tons, especially when they're in the form of slender rods, tens of thousands of kilometers long, back into position. And there's no need to. Fortunately for us.
Not for us, interjected the Mahanayaki Thero, almost throwing Morgan off his stride.
There are two stable points on the synchronous orbit. A satellite placed at them will stay there. It won't drift away, just as if it's stuck at the bottom of an invisible valley. One of those points is out over the Pacific, so it's no use to us. The other is directly above our heads.
Surely a few kilometers one way or the other would make no difference. There are other mountains in Taprobani.
None more than half the height of Srikanda, which brings us down to the level of critical wind forces. True, there are not many hurricanes exactly on the equator, but there are enough to endanger the structure at its very weakest point. We can control the winds.
It was the first contribution the young secretary had made to the discussion, and Morgan looked at him with heightened interest.
To some extent, yes. Naturally, I have discussed this point with monsoon control. They say that absolute certainty is out of the question, especially with hurricanes. The best odds they will give me are 50 to 1. That's not good enough for a $1 trillion project.
The venerable Parakarma seemed inclined to argue.
There is an almost forgotten branch of mathematics called catastrophe theory, which could make meteorology a really precise science. I am confident that...
I should explain, the Mahanayaki Thero interjected blandly, that my colleague was once rather celebrated for his astronomical work. I imagine you have heard of Dr. Choam Goldberg.
Morgan felt that a trap door had been opened beneath him. He should have been warned. Then he recalled that Professor Sarath had indeed told him, with a twinkle in his eye, that he should
watch out for Buddy's private secretary. He's a very smart character.
Morgan wondered if his cheeks were burning as the venerable Parakarma, alias Dr. Choam Goldberg, looked back at him with a distinctly unfriendly expression. So he had been trying to explain orbital instabilities to these innocent monks. The Mahanayaki Thero had probably received much better briefing on the subject than he had given. He remembered that the world's scientists were neatly divided on the subject of Dr. Goldberg into those who were sure that he was crazy and those who had not yet made up their minds. He had been one of the most promising young men in the field of astrophysics when, 5 years ago, he had announced,
"Now that Starglider has effectively destroyed all traditional religions, we can at last pay serious attention to the concept of God."
And with that, he had disappeared from public view. 16. Conversations with Starglider.
Of all the thousands of questions put to Starglider during its transit of the solar system, those whose answers were most eagerly awaited concerned the living creatures and civilizations of other stars. Contrary to some expectations, the robot answered willingly, though it admitted that its last update on the subject had been received over a century ago. Considering the immense range of cultures produced on Earth by a single species, it was obvious that there would be even greater variety among the stars, where every conceivable type of biology might occur. Several thousand hours of fascinating, often incomprehensible, sometimes horrifying, scenes of life on other planets left no doubt that this was the case. Nevertheless, the Starholmers had managed a rough classification of cultures according to their standards of technology, perhaps the only objective basis possible. Humanity was interested to discover that it came in Category 5 on a scale that used these approximate stages: 1. Stone tools. 2. Metals. Fire. 3. Writing, handicrafts, ships. 4. Steam power. Basic science. 5. Atomic energy, space travel. When Starglider had begun its mission 60,000 years ago, its builders were, like the human race, still in Category 5. They had now graduated to 6, characterized by the ability to convert matter completely into energy and to transmute all elements on an industrial scale. "And is there a Category 7? Starglider was immediately asked. The reply was a brief affirmative. When pressed for details, the probe explained, "I am not allowed to describe the technology of a higher-grade culture to a lower one." There the matter remained, right up to the moment of the final message, despite all the leading questions designed by the most ingenious legal brains of Earth. By that time, Starglider was more than a match for any terrestrial logician. This was partly the fault of the University of Chicago's Department of Philosophy. In a fit of monumental hubris, it had clandestinely transmitted the whole of Summa Theologica, with disastrous results. 2069, June 2nd, GMT, 1934. Message 1946. Sequence 2. Starglider to Earth. "I have analyzed the arguments of your St. Thomas Aquinas as requested in your message 145, sequence 3 of 2069, June 2nd, GMT, 1842. Most of the content appears to be sense-free, random noise, and so devoid of information. But the printout that follows lists 192 fallacies expressed in the symbolic logic of your reference, Mathematics 43, of 2069, May 29th, GMT 0251. Fallacy 1. There followed a 75-page printout. As the log timings show, it took Starglider less than an hour to demolish St. Thomas. Although philosophers were to spend the next several decades arguing over the analysis, they found only 2 errors, and those could have been due to a misunderstanding of terminology. It would have been most interesting to know what fraction of its processing circuit Starglider applied to this task. Unfortunately, no one thought of asking before the probe had switched to cruise mode and broken contact. By then, even more deflating messages had been received. 2069, June 4th, GMT, 0759. Message 9056. Sequence 2. Starglider to Earth. "I am unable to distinguish clearly between your religious ceremonies and apparently identical behavior at the sporting and cultural functions you have transmitted to me. I refer you particularly to the Beatles, 1956, the World Soccer Final, 2047, and the farewell appearance of the Johann Sebastian clones, 2056. 2069, June 5th, GMT, 2038. Message 4675, Sequence 2. Starglider to Earth. "My last update on this matter is 175 years old, but if I understand you correctly, the answer is as follows.
Behavior of the type you call religious occurred among 3 of the 15 known Category 1 cultures, 6 of the 28 Category 2 cultures, 5 of the 14 Category 3 cultures, 2 of the 10 Category 4 cultures, and 3 of the 174 Category 5 cultures. You will appreciate that we have many more examples of Category 5, because only they can be detected over astronomical distances. 2069, June 6th, GMT, 1209. Message 5897. Sequence 2. Star glider to Earth. You are correct in deducing that the 3 Category 5 cultures that engaged in religious activities had 2 parent reproduction, and the young remained in family groups for a large fraction of their lifetime. How did you arrive at this conclusion? 2069, June 8th, GMT, 1537. Message 6943. Sequence 2. Star glider to Earth. The hypothesis you refer to as God, though not disprovable by logic alone, is unnecessary for the following reason. If you assume that the universe can be, quote, explained, unquote, as the creation of an entity known as God, he must obviously be of a higher degree of organization than his product. Thus, you have more than doubled the size of the original problem and have taken the first step on a diverging infinite regress. William of Ockham pointed out as recently as your 14th century that entities should not be multiplied unnecessarily. I cannot therefore understand why this debate continues. 2069, June 11th, GMT, 0684. Message 8964. Sequence 2. Star glider to Earth. Starholm informed me 456 years ago that the origin of the universe has been discovered, but that I do not have the appropriate circuits to comprehend it. You must communicate directly for further information. I am now switching to cruise mode and must break contact. Goodbye. In the opinion of many, that final and most famous of all its thousands of messages proved that Starglider had a sense of humor. Why else would it have waited until the very end to explode such a philosophical bombshell? Or was the entire conversation all part of a careful plan designed to put the human race in the right frame of reference for the time when the first direct messages from Starholm arrived, in, presumably, 104 years? There were some who suggested following Starglider, since it was carrying out of the solar system not only immeasurable stores of knowledge, but also the treasures of a technology centuries ahead of anything possessed by man. Although no spaceship existed that could overtake Starglider and return again to Earth after matching its enormous velocity, one could certainly be built. However, wiser counsels prevailed. Even a robot space probe might have very effective defenses against its borders, including, as a last resort, the ability to self-destruct. But the most telling argument was that its builders were only 52 light-years away. During the millennia since they had launched Starglider, their spacefaring ability must have improved enormously. If the human race did anything to provoke them, they might arrive slightly annoyed in a few hundred years. Meanwhile, among all its countless other effects upon human culture, Starglider had brought to its climax a process that was already well underway. It had put an end to the billions of words of pious gibberish with which apparently intelligent men had addled their minds for centuries. 17. Parakarma. As he quickly checked back on the conversation, Morgan decided that he had not made a fool of himself. Indeed, the Mahanayaki Thero might have lost a tactical advantage by revealing the identity of the venerable Parakarma. Yet it was no particular secret. Perhaps he thought that Morgan already knew. At this point, there was a rather welcome interruption, as 2 young acolytes filed into the office, one carrying a tray loaded with small dishes of rice, fruits, and what appeared to be thin pancakes, while the other followed with the inevitable pot of tea.
There was nothing that looked like meat. After his long night, Morgan would have welcomed a couple of eggs, but he assumed that they too were forbidden. No, that was too strong a word. Sarath had told him that the order prohibited nothing, believing in no absolutes, but it had a nicely calibrated scale of toleration, and the taking of life, even potential life, was very low on the list. As he started to sample the various items, most of them quite unknown to him, Morgan looked inquiringly at the Mahanayaki Thero, who shook his head.
"We do not eat before noon. The mind functions more clearly in the morning hours, and so should not be distracted by material things."
As he nibbled at some quite delicious papaya, Morgan considered the philosophical guilt represented by that simple statement. To him, an empty stomach could be most distracting, completely inhibiting the higher mental functions. Having always been blessed with good health, he had never tried to dissociate mind and body, and saw no reason why one should make the attempt. While Morgan was eating his exotic breakfast, the Mahanayake Thero excused himself, and for a few minutes his fingers danced with dazzling speed over the keyboard of his console. Since the readout was in full view, politeness compelled Morgan to look elsewhere. Inevitably, his eyes fell upon the head of the Buddha. It was probably real, for the plinth cast a faint shadow on the wall behind. Yet even that was not conclusive. The plinth might be solid enough, and the head a projection, carefully positioned on top of it. The trick was a common one. Here was a work of art that, like the Mona Lisa, both mirrored the emotions of the observer and imposed its own authority upon them. La Gioconda's eyes were open, however, though what they were looking at no one would ever know. The eyes of the Buddha were completely blank, empty pools in which a man might lose his soul or discover a universe. Upon the lips there lingered a smile even more ambiguous than the Mona Lisa's. Yet was it really a smile, or merely a trick of the lighting? Already it was gone, replaced by an expression of superhuman tranquility. Morgan could not tear his eyes away from that hypnotic countenance, and only the familiar rustling whir of a hard copy readout from the console brought him back to reality, if this was reality.
"I thought you might like a souvenir of your visit," said the Mahanayake Thero.
As Morgan accepted the proffered sheet, he was surprised to see that it was archival-quality parchment, not the usual flimsy paper destined to be thrown away after a few hours of use. He could not read a single word. Except for an unobtrusive alphanumeric reference in the bottom left-hand corner, it was all in the flowering curlicues that he could now recognize as Taprobani script. "Thank you," he said, with as much irony as he could muster. "What is it?" He had a good idea. Legal documents had a close family resemblance, whatever their languages or eras.
"A copy of the agreement between King Ravindra and the Mahanayaki Sangha, dated Vaisak AD 854 of your calendar. It defines the ownership of the temple land in perpetuity. The rights set out in this document were even recognized by the invaders. By the Caledonians and the Hollanders, I believe, but not by the Iberians." If the Mahanayake Thero was surprised by the thoroughness of Morgan's briefing, not even the twitch of an eyebrow betrayed the fact. "They were hardly respecters of law and order, particularly where other religions were concerned. I trust that their philosophy of might equals right does not appeal to you." Morgan gave a somewhat forced smile. "It certainly does not," he answered. "But where did one draw the line?" he asked himself silently. When the overwhelming interests of great organizations were at stake, conventional morality often took second place. The best legal minds on earth, human and electronic, would soon be focused upon this spot. If they could not find the right answers, a very unpleasant situation might develop, one that could make him a villain, not a hero.
"Since you have raised the subject of the 854 agreement, let me remind you that it refers only to the land inside the temple boundaries, which are clearly defined by the walls."
"Correct, but they enclose the entire summit.
You have no control over the ground outside this area.
We have the rights of any owner of property. If the neighbors create a nuisance, we would have legal redress. This is not the first time the point has been raised.
I know, in connection with the cable car system.
A faint smile played over the Mahanayaki Thero's lips.
You have done your homework, he commended. Yes, we opposed it vigorously, for a number of reasons, though I admit that now it is here, we have often been thankful for it.
He paused thoughtfully, then added,
There have been some problems, but we have been able to coexist. Casual sightseers and tourists are content to stay on the lookout platform. Genuine pilgrims, of course, we are always happy to welcome at the summit.
Then perhaps some accommodation could be worked out in this case. A few hundred meters of altitude would make no difference to us. We could leave the summit untouched and carve out another plateau, like the cable car terminus.
Morgan felt distinctly uncomfortable under the prolonged scrutiny of the two monks. He had little doubt that they recognized the absurdity of the suggestion, but for the sake of the record he had to make it.
You have a most peculiar sense of humor, Dr. Morgan, the Mahanayaki Thero replied at last. What would be left of the spirit of the mountain, of the solitude we have sought for 3,000 years, if this monstrous device is erected here? Do you expect us to betray the faith of all the millions who have come to this sacred spot, often at the cost of their health, even their lives?
I sympathize with your feelings, Morgan answered.
But was he lying, he wondered.
We would, of course, do our best to minimize any disturbance. All the support facilities will be buried inside the mountain. Only the elevator would emerge, and from any distance it would be quite invisible. The general aspect of the mountain would be totally unchanged. Even your famous shadow, which I have just admired, would be virtually unaffected.
The Mahanayaki Thero turned to his colleague as if seeking confirmation. The venerable Parakarma looked straight at Morgan and said,
What about noise?
Damn, Morgan thought, my weakest point. The payloads would emerge from the mountain at several hundred kilometers an hour. The more velocity they could be given by the ground-based system, the less the strain on the suspended tower. Of course, passengers couldn't take more than half a G or so, but the capsules would still pop out at a substantial fraction of the speed of sound.
There will be some aerodynamic noise, Morgan admitted, but nothing like that near a large airport.
Very reassuring, said the Mahanayaki Thero.
Morgan was certain that he was being sarcastic, though he could detect no trace of irony in his voice. He was either displaying an Olympian calm or testing his visitor's reactions. The younger monk, on the other hand, made no attempt to conceal his anger.
For years, he said with indignation, we have been protesting about the disturbance caused by re-entering spacecraft. Now you want to generate shockwaves in our back garden.
Our operations will not be transonic at this altitude, Morgan replied firmly,
and the tower structure will absorb most of the sound energy. In fact, he added, trying to press what he had suddenly seen as an advantage, in the long run, we'll help to eliminate re-entry booms. The mountain will actually be a quieter place. I understand. Instead of occasional concussions, we will have a steady roar.
I'm not getting anywhere with this character, thought Morgan, and I'd expected the Mahanayaki Thero to be the biggest obstacle. Sometimes it was best to change the subject entirely. He decided to dip one cautious toe into the quaking quagmire of theology.
Isn't there something appropriate, he said earnestly, in what we are trying to do? Our purposes may be different, but the net results have much in common. What we hope to build is only an extension of your stairway. If I may say so, we are continuing it all the way to heaven.
For a moment, the venerable Parakarma seemed taken aback at such effrontery. Before he could recover, his superior answered smoothly,
An interesting concept, but our philosophy does not believe in heaven.
Such salvation as may exist can be found only in this world, and I sometimes wonder at your anxiety to leave it. Do you know the story of the Tower of Babel?
Vaguely.
I suggest you look it up in the old Christian Bible, Genesis 11. That, too, was an engineering project to scale the heavens. It failed, owing to difficulties in communication.
Though we will have our problems, I don't think that will be one of them.
But looking at the venerable Parakarma, Morgan was not so sure. Here was a communications gap that seemed in some ways greater than that between Homo sapiens and Starglider. They spoke the same language, but there were gulfs of incomprehension that might never be spanned.
May I ask, continued the Mahanayake Thero with imperturbable politeness, how successful you were with the Department of Parks and Forests?
They were extremely cooperative.
I am not surprised. They are chronically under-budgeted, and any new source of revenue would be welcome.
The cable system was a financial windfall, and doubtless they hope your project will be an even bigger one.
They will be right, and they have accepted the fact that it won't create any environmental hazards.
Suppose it falls down.
Morgan looked the monk straight in the eye.
It won't, he said,
with all the authority of the man whose inverted rainbow now linked two continents. But he knew, and the implacable Parakarma must also know, that absolute certainty was impossible in such matters. 202 years ago, on 7 November 1940, that lesson had been driven home in a way that no engineer could ever forget. Morgan had few nightmares, but that was one of them. Even at this moment, the computers at Terran Construction were trying to exorcise it. But all the computing power in the universe could provide no protection against the problems he had not foreseen, the nightmares that were still unborn.
18. The Golden Butterflies. Despite the brilliant sunlight and the magnificent views that assailed him from every side, Morgan was fast asleep before the car had descended into the lowlands. Even the innumerable hairpin bends failed to keep him awake. But he was snapped back into consciousness when the brakes were slammed on and he was pitched forward against his seatbelt. For a moment of utter confusion, he thought that he must still be dreaming. The breeze blowing gently through the half-open windows was so warm and humid that it might have escaped from a Turkish bath. Yet the car had apparently come to a halt in the midst of a blinding snowstorm. Morgan blinked, screwed up his eyes, and opened them to reality. This was the first time he had ever seen golden snow. A dense swarm of butterflies was crossing the road, headed due east in a steady, purposeful migration. Some had been sucked into the car and fluttered around frantically until Morgan waved them out. Many more had plastered themselves on the windshield. With what were doubtless a few choice Tap Robiny expletives, the driver emerged and wiped the glass clear. By the time he had finished, the swarm had thinned out to a handful of isolated stragglers.
"Did they tell you about the legend?"
he asked, glancing back at his passenger.
"No," said Morgan curtly. He was not at all interested, being anxious to resume his interrupted nap.
"The golden butterflies. They're the souls of Kalidasa's warriors, the army he lost at Yakagala."
Morgan gave an unenthusiastic grunt, hoping that the driver would get the message, but he continued remorselessly.
"Every year around this time, they head for the mountain, and they all die on its lower slopes. Sometimes you'll meet them halfway up the cable ride, but that's the highest they get, which is lucky for the Vihara."
"The Vihara?" asked Morgan sleepily.
"The temple. If they ever reach it, Kalidasa will have conquered, and the bhikkhus, the monks, will have to leave. That's the prophecy. It's carved on a stone slab in the Ranapura Museum. I can show it to you."
"Some other time," said Morgan hastily as he settled back into the padded seat.
But it was many kilometers before he could doze off again, because there was something haunting about the image that the driver had conjured up. He would remember it often in the months ahead,
when waking and in moments of stress or crisis. Once again he would be immersed in that golden snowstorm as the doomed millions spent their energies in a vain assault upon the mountain and all that it symbolized. Even now, at the very beginning of his campaign, the image was too close for comfort. 19. By the shores of Lake Saladin. Almost all the alternative history computer simulations suggested that the Battle of Tours, AD 732, was one of the crucial disasters of mankind. Had Charles Martel been defeated, Islam might have resolved the internal differences that were tearing it apart and gone on to conquer Europe. Thus, centuries of Christian barbarism would have been avoided, the Industrial Revolution would have started almost 1,000 years earlier, and by now we would have reached the nearer stars instead of merely the farther planets. But fate ruled otherwise, and the armies of the Prophet turned back into Africa. Islam lingered on, a fascinating fossil, until the end of the 20th century. Then, abruptly, it was dissolved in oil. Chairman's Address, Toynbee Bicentennial Symposium, London, 2089.
"Did you know," said Sheikh Farouk Abdullah, "that I have now appointed myself Grand Admiral of the Sahara Fleet?"
"It wouldn't surprise me, Mr. President," Morgan answered as he gazed out across the sparkling blue expanse of Lake Saladin. "If it's not a naval secret, how many ships do you have?"
10 at the moment. The largest is a 30-meter hydro-skimmer run by the Red Crescent. It spends every weekend rescuing incompetent sailors. My people still aren't much good on the water. Look at that idiot trying to tack. After all, 200 years really isn't long enough to switch from camels to boats.
You had Cadillacs and Rolls-Royces in between. Surely that should have eased the transition.
And we still have them. My great-great-great-grandfather's silver ghost is just as good as new. But I must be fair, it's the visitors who get into trouble trying to cope with our local winds. We stick to powerboats. And next year I'm getting a submarine, guaranteed to reach the lake's maximum depth of 78 meters.
Whatever for?
Now they tell us that the Urg was full of archaeological treasures. Of course, no one bothered about them before it was flooded.
It was no use trying to hurry the president of Anar, the autonomous North African Republic, and Morgan knew better than to attempt it. Whatever the Constitution might say, Sheikh Abdullah controlled more power and wealth than almost any single individual on Earth. More to the point, he understood the uses of both. He came of a family that was not afraid to take risks, and seldom had cause to regret them. Its first and most famous gamble, which had incurred the hatred of the whole Arab world for almost half a century, was the investment of its abundant petrodollars in the science and technology of Israel. That far-sighted act had led directly to the mining of the Red Sea, the defeat of the deserts, and, very much later, to the Gibraltar Bridge.
"I don't have to tell you, Van," said the Sheikh at last, "how much your new project fascinates me. And after all that we went through together while the bridge was being built, I know that you could do it, given the resources."
"Thank you.
But I have a few questions. I'm not clear why there's Midway Station, and why it's at a height of 25,000 kilometers.
"Several reasons. We need a major power plant at about that level, which would involve fairly massive construction there in any case. Then it occurred to us that 7 hours was too long to stay cooped up in a rather cramped cabin, and splitting the journey would give a number of advantages. We wouldn't have to feed the passengers in transit. They could eat and stretch their legs at the station. We could also optimize the vehicle design. Only the capsules on the lower section would have to be streamlined. Those on the upper run could be much simpler and lighter. Midway Station would serve not only as a transfer point, but also as an operations and control center,
and ultimately, we believe, as a major tourist attraction and resort in its own right.
But it's not Midway. It's almost, two-thirds of the distance up to stationary orbit.
True. The midpoint would be at 18,000, not 25. But there's another factor. Safety. If the section above is severed, Midway Station won't crash back to Earth.
Why not?
It will have enough momentum to maintain a stable orbit. Of course, it will fall earthward, but it will always remain clear of the atmosphere, so it will be perfectly safe. It will simply become a space station, moving in a 10-hour elliptical orbit. Twice a day, it will be right back where it started from, and eventually it could be reconnected, in theory at least.
And in practice?
Oh, I'm sure it could be done. Certainly the people and equipment on the station could be saved, but we wouldn't have even that option if we established it at a lower altitude. Anything falling from below the 25,000-kilometer limit hits the atmosphere and burns up in 5 hours, or less.
Do you propose advertising this fact to passengers on the Earth Midway run?
We hope they will be too busy admiring the view to worry about it.
You make it sound like a scenic elevator.
Why not? Except that the tallest scenic ride on Earth goes up a mere 3 kilometers. We're talking about something 10,000 times higher.
There was a considerable pause while the Sheikh Abdullah thought this over.
We missed an opportunity, he said at last. We could have had 5 kilometer scenic rides up the piers of the bridge.
They were in the original design, but we dropped them for the usual reason, economy.
Perhaps we made a mistake. They could have paid for themselves. And I've just realized something else. If this hyperfilament had been available at the time, I suppose the bridge could have been built for half the cost.
I wouldn't lie to you, Mr. President. Less than a fifth. But construction would have been delayed more than 20 years, so you haven't lost by it.
I must talk that over with my accountants. Some of them still aren't convinced it was a good idea, even though the traffic growth rate is ahead of projection. But I keep telling them that money isn't everything. The Republic needed the bridge psychologically and culturally, as well as economically. Did you know that 18% of the people who drive across it do so just because it's there, not for any other reason? And then they go straight back again, despite having to pay the toll both ways.
I seem to recall, said Morgan dryly, giving you similar arguments a long time ago. You weren't easy to convince.
True. I remember that the Sydney Opera House was your favorite example. You liked to point out how many times that had paid for itself, even in hard cash, let alone prestige.
And don't forget the pyramids.
The Sheikh laughed.
What did you call them? The best investment in the history of mankind?
Precisely. Still paying tourist dividends after 4,000 years.
Hardly a fair comparison, though. Their running costs don't compare with those of the bridge, much less your proposed towers.
The tower may last longer than the pyramids. It's in a far more benign environment.
That's a very impressive thought. You really believe that it will operate for several thousand years?
Not in its original form, of course, but in principle, yes. Whatever technical developments the future brings, I don't believe there will ever be a more efficient, more economical way of reaching space. Think of it as another bridge, but this time a bridge to the stars, or at least to the planets.
And once again, you'd like us to help finance it. We'll still be paying for the last bridge for another 20 years. It's not as if your space elevator was on our territory, or was of direct importance to us.
But I believe it is, Mr. President. Your republic is a part of the Terran economy, and the cost of space transportation is now one of the factors limiting its growth. If you've looked at those estimates for the 50s and 60s...
I have. Very interesting. But though we're not exactly poor, we couldn't raise a fraction of the funds needed. Why, it would absorb the entire gross world product for a couple of years.
And pay it back every 15, forever afterward.
If your projections are correct.
They were for the bridge. But you're right, of course, and I don't expect Anar to do more than start the ball rolling. Once you've shown your interest, it will be that much easier to get other support.
Such as?
The World Bank, the Planetary Banks, the Federal Government.
And your own employers, the Terran Construction Corporation? What are you really up to, Van?
Here it comes, thought Morgan, almost with a sigh of relief. Now at last he could talk frankly with someone he could trust, someone who was too big to be involved in petty bureaucratic intrigues, but who could thoroughly appreciate their finer points.
I've been doing most of this work in my own time. I'm on vacation right now. And incidentally, that's just how the bridge started. I don't know if I ever told you that I was once officially ordered to forget it. I've learned a few lessons in the past 15 years.
This report must have taken a good deal of computer time. Who paid for that?
Oh, I have considerable discretionary funds, and my staff is always doing studies that nobody else can understand. To tell the truth, I've had quite a little team playing with the idea for several months. They're so enthusiastic that they spend most of their free time on it as well. But now we have to commit ourselves, or abandon the project.
Does your esteemed chairman know about this?
Morgan smiled, without much humor.
Of course not, and I don't want to tell him until I've worked out all the details.
I can appreciate some of the complications, said the president shrewdly. One of them, I imagine, is ensuring that Senator Collins doesn't invent it first.
He can't do that. The idea is about 200 years old. But he, and a lot of other people, could slow it down. I want to see it happen in my lifetime.
And, of course, you intend to be in charge. Well, what exactly would you like us to do?
This is merely one suggestion, Mr. President. You may have a better idea. Form a consortium, perhaps including the Gibraltar Bridge Authority, the Suez and Panama Corporations, the English Channel Company, the Bering Dam Corporation. Then, when it's all wrapped up, approach TCC with a request for a feasibility study. At this stage, the investment will be negligible.
Meaning?
Less than $1 million, especially since I've already done 90% of the work.
And then?
Thereafter, with your backing, Mr. President, I can play it by ear. I might stay with TCC, or I might resign and join the consortium. Call it Astro Engineering. It would all depend on circumstances. I would do whatever seemed best for the project.
That seems a reasonable approach. I think we can work something out.
Thank you, Mr. President, Morgan answered with heartfelt sincerity. But there's one annoying roadblock we have to tackle at once, perhaps even before we set up the consortium. We have to go to the World Court and establish jurisdiction over the most valuable piece of real estate on Earth.
20. The Bridge That Danced. Even in this age of instantaneous communication and swift global transport, it was convenient to have a place that one could call one's office. Not everything could be stored in patterns of electronic charges. There were still such items as good old-fashioned books, professional certificates, awards and honors, engineering models, samples of material, artists' renderings of projects, not as accurate as a computer's, but very ornamental, and of course the wall-to-wall carpet that every senior bureaucrat needed to soften the impact of external reality. Morgan's office, which he saw on the average 10 days per month, was on the 6th, or land floor, of the sprawling Terran Construction Corporation headquarters in Nairobi. The floor below was C, that above it, administration, meaning Chairman Collins and his empire. The architect, in a fit of naive symbolism, had devoted the top floor to space. There was even a small observatory on the roof, with a 30-centimeter telescope, which was always out of order because it was used only during office parties and frequently for very non-astronomical purposes. The upper rooms of the Triplanetary Hotel, only a kilometer away, were a favorite target,
since they often held some extremely strange forms of life, or at any rate, of behavior. Since Morgan was in continuous touch with his two secretaries, one human, the other electronic, he expected no surprises when he walked into his office after the brief flight from Anar. By the standards of an earlier age, his was an extraordinarily small organization. He had fewer than 300 men and women under his direct control, but the computing and information processing power at their command could not be matched by the merely human population of the entire planet. "Well, how'd you get on with the Sheik?" asked Warren Kingsley, his deputy and longtime friend, as soon as they were alone together.
"Very well. I think we have a deal. But I still can't believe that we're held up by such a stupid problem. What does the legal department say?"
"We'll definitely have to get a world court ruling. If the court agrees that it's a matter of overwhelming public interest, our reverend friends will have to move. Though, if they decide to be stubborn, there would be a nasty situation. Perhaps you should send a small earthquake to help them make up their minds." The fact that Morgan was on the board of General Tectonics was an old joke between him and Kingsley, but GT, perhaps fortunately, had never found a way of controlling and directing earthquakes, nor did it ever expect to do so. The best that it could hope for was to predict them and to bleed off their energies harmlessly before they could do major damage. Even here, its record of success was not much better than 75%.
"A nice idea," said Morgan. "I'll think it over. Now, what about our other problem?"
"All set to go. Do you want it now?"
"Okay, let's see the worst."
The office windows darkened, and a grid of glowing lines appeared in the center of the room.
"Watch this, Van," said Kingsley. "Here's the regime that gives trouble."
Rows of letters and numbers materialized in the empty air. Velocities, payloads, accelerations, transit times. Morgan absorbed them at a glance. The globe of the Earth, with its circles of longitude and latitude, hovered just above the carpet, and rising from it, to little more than the height of a man, was the luminous thread that marked the position of the orbital tower. 500 times normal speed, lateral scale exaggeration 50. Here we go. Some invisible force had started to pluck at the line of light, drawing it away from the vertical. The disturbance was moving upward as it mimicked, via the computer's millions of calculations a second, the ascent of a payload through the Earth's gravitational field.
"What's the displacement?" asked Morgan as his eyes strained to follow the details of the simulation.
"Now about 200 meters. It gets to 3 before..."
The thread snapped. In the leisurely slow motion that represented real speeds of thousands of kilometers an hour, the two segments of the severed tower began to curl away from each other, one bending back to Earth, the other whipping upward to space. But Morgan was no longer fully conscious of this imaginary disaster, existing only in the mind of the computer. Superimposed upon it now was the reality that had haunted him for years. He had seen that two-century-old film at least 50 times, and there were sections that he had examined frame by frame until he knew every detail by heart. It was, after all, the most expensive movie footage ever shot, at least in peacetime. It had cost the state of Washington several million dollars a minute. There stood the slim, too slim, and graceful bridge spanning the canyon. It bore no traffic, but a single car had been abandoned midway by its driver. And no wonder, for the bridge was behaving as none before in the whole history of engineering. It seemed impossible that thousands of tons of metal could perform such an aerial ballet. One could more easily believe that the bridge was made of rubber than of steel. Vast, slow undulations, meters in amplitude, were sweeping along the entire width of the span, so that the roadway suspended between the piers twisted back and forth like an angry snake. The wind blowing down the canyon was sounding a note far too low for any human ears to detect as it hit the natural frequency of the beautiful doomed structure. For hours, the torsional vibrations had been building up, but no one knew when the end would come. Already the protracted death throes were a testimonial that the unlucky designers could well have foregone. Suddenly, the supporting cables snapped, flailing upward like murderous steel whips. Twisting and turning, the roadway pitched into the river, fragments of the structure flying in all directions. Even when projected at normal speed, the final cataclysm looked as if shot in slow motion. The scale of the disaster was so large that the human mind had no basis of comparison. In reality, it lasted perhaps 5 seconds. At the end of that time, the Tacoma Narrows Bridge had earned an inexpugnable place in the history of engineering. 200 years later, there was a photograph of its last moments on the wall of Morgan's office, bearing the caption, "One of the more expensive products." To Morgan, that was no joke, but a permanent reminder that the unexpected could always strike from ambush. When the Gibraltar Bridge was being designed, he had gone carefully through Theodore von Karman's classic analysis of the Tacoma Narrows disaster, learning all he could from one of the most expensive mistakes of the past. There had been no serious vibrational problems, even in the worst gales that had come roaring in from the Atlantic, though the roadway had moved 100 meters from the center line, precisely as calculated. But the space elevator was such a leap forward into the unknown that some unpleasant surprises were a virtual certainty. Wind forces in the atmospheric section were easy to estimate, but it was also necessary to take into account the vibrations induced by the stopping and starting of the payloads, and even, on so enormous a structure, by the tidal effects of the sun and the moon. And not only individually, but acting all together, with perhaps an occasional earthquake to complicate the picture in the so-called worst-case analysis. All the simulations, in this tons of payload per hour regime, give the same result. The vibrations build up until there's a fraction at around 500 kilometers. We'll have to increase the damping drastically.
I was afraid of that. How much do we need?
Another 10 megatons. Morgan could take some gloomy satisfaction from the figure. That was close to the guess he had made, using his engineer's intuition and the mysterious resources of his subconscious. Now the computer had confirmed it. They would have to increase the anchor mass in orbit by 10 million tons. Even by terrestrial Earth-moving standards, such a mass was hardly trivial. It was equivalent to a sphere of rock about 200 meters across. Morgan had a sudden image of Yakagala, as he had last seen it, looming against the Taprobanian sky. Imagine lifting that 40,000 kilometers into space. Fortunately, it might not be necessary. There were alternatives. Morgan always let his subordinates do their thinking for themselves. It was the only way to establish responsibility. It took much of the load off him, and on many occasions his staff arrived at solutions he had overlooked.
"What do you suggest, Warren?"
he asked quietly. "We could use one of the lunar freight launchers and shoot up 10 megatons of moon rock. It would be a long and expensive job, and we'd need a large space-based operation to catch the material and steer it into final orbit. There would also be a psychological problem."
"Yes, I can appreciate that. We don't want another San Luis Domingo."
San Luis had been the fortunately small South American village that had received a stray cargo of processed lunar metal intended for a low-orbit space station. The terminal guidance had failed, resulting in the first man-made meteor crater and 250 deaths. Ever since that, the population of planet Earth had been very sensitive on the subject of celestial target practice. "A much better answer is to catch an asteroid. We're running a search for those with suitable orbits and have found 3 promising candidates. What we really want is a carbonaceous one. Then we can use it for raw material when we set up the processing plant, killing 2 birds with 1 stone.
A rather large stone, but that's probably the best idea.
Forget the lunar launcher. 1,000,000 10-ton shots would tie it up for years, and some of them would be bound to go astray. If you can't find a large enough asteroid, we can send the extra mass up by the elevator itself, though I hate wasting all that energy if it can be avoided."
"It may be the cheapest way. With the efficiency of the latest fusion plants, it will take only $20 worth of electricity to lift a ton up to orbit."
"Are you sure of that figure?"
"It's a firm quotation from Central Power." Morgan was silent for a few minutes. Then he said,
"The aerospace engineers really are going to hate me."
Almost as much, he added to himself, as the venerable Parakarma. No, that was not fair. Hate was an emotion no longer possible to a true follower of the doctrine. What he had seen in the eyes of former Dr. Choam Goldberg was merely implacable opposition, but that could be equally dangerous. 21. Judgment. One of Paul Sarath's more annoying specialties was the sudden call, gleeful or gloomy as the case might be, which invariably consisted of the words, "Have you heard the news?" Though Raja Singh had often been tempted to give the general-purpose answer, "Yes, I'm not at all surprised," he had never had the heart to rob Sarath of his simple pleasure.
"What is it this time?"
he answered, without much enthusiasm.
"Maxine's on Global 2, talking to Senator Collins. I think our friend Morgan is in trouble. Call you back."
Sarath's excited image faded from the screen, to be replaced a few seconds later by Maxine Duval's, as Raja Singh switched to the news analysis channel. She was sitting in her familiar studio, talking to the chairman of the Terran Construction Corporation, who seemed to be in a mood of barely suppressed indignation, probably synthetic.
"Senator Collins, now that the World Court ruling has been given," Raja Singh shunted the entire program to record with a muttered, "I thought that wasn't until Friday."
As he turned off the sound and activated his private link with Aristotle, he exclaimed,
"My God, it is Friday."
As always, Ari was on the line at once.
"Good morning, Raja. What can I do for you?"
That beautiful, dispassionate voice, untouched by human glottis, had never changed in the 40 years that he had known it. Decades, perhaps centuries after he was dead, it would be talking to other men just as it had spoken to him. For that matter, how many conversations was it having at this very moment? Once this knowledge had depressed Raja Singh, now it no longer mattered. He did not envy Aristotle's immortality.
"Good morning, Ari. I'd like today's World Court ruling on the Astro Engineering Corporation versus the Sri Kanda Vihara case. The summary will do. Let me have the full printout later."
"Decision 1. Lease of temple site confirmed in perpetuity under Taprobanian and world law as codified 2085. Unanimous ruling. Decision 2. The construction of the proposed orbital tower, with its attendant noise, vibration, and its impact upon a site of great historic and cultural importance, would constitute a private nuisance, meriting an injunction under the law of torts. At this stage, public interest not of sufficient merit to affect the issue. Ruling 4-2. 1 abstention.
"Thank you, Ari. Cancel printout. I won't need it. Goodbye."
Well, that was that, just as he had expected. Yet he did not know whether to be relieved or disappointed. Rooted as he was in the past, he was glad that old traditions were cherished and protected. If one thing had been learned from the bloody history of mankind, it was that only individual human beings mattered. However eccentric their beliefs might be, they must be safeguarded, so long as they did not conflict with wider but equally legitimate interests. What was it that the old poet had said? There is no such thing as the state. Perhaps that was going a little too far, but it was better than the other extreme. At the same time, Raja Singh felt a mild sense of regret. He had half convinced himself, was this merely cooperating with the inevitable, that Morgan's fantastic enterprise might be just what was needed to prevent Taprobany and perhaps the whole world, though that was no longer his responsibility, from sinking into a comfortable, self-satisfied decline. Now the court had closed that particular avenue, at least for many years. He wondered what Duval would have to say on the subject and switched over to delayed playback. On Global 2, sometimes referred to as the land of talking heads, Senator Collins was still gathering momentum.
"Undoubtedly exceeding his authority and using the resources of his division on projects that did not concern it.
But surely, Senator, aren't you being somewhat legalistic? As I understand it, hyperfilament was developed for construction purposes, especially bridges. And isn't this a kind of bridge? I've heard Dr. Morgan use that analogy, though he also calls it a tower.
You're being legalistic now, Maxine. I prefer the name space elevator. And you're quite wrong about hyperfilament. It's the result of 200 years of aerospace research. The fact that the final breakthrough came in the land division of my, organization is irrelevant, though naturally I'm proud that my scientists were involved.
You consider that the whole project should be handed over to the space division?
What project? This is merely a design study, one of hundreds that are always going on at TCC. I never hear about a fraction of them, and I don't want to, until they reach the stage when some major decision has to be made.
Which is not the case here.
Definitely not. My space transportation experts say that they can handle all projected traffic increases, at least for the foreseeable future.
Meaning, precisely?
Another 20 years.
And what happens then? The tower will take that long to build, according to Dr. Morgan. Suppose it isn't ready in time.
Then we'll have something else. My staff is looking into all the possibilities, and it's by no means certain that the space elevator is the right answer.
The idea, though, is fundamentally sound.
It appears to be, though further studies are required.
Then surely you should be grateful to Dr. Morgan for his initial work.
I have the utmost respect for Dr. Morgan. He is one of the most brilliant engineers in my organization, if not in the world.
I don't think, Senator, that quite answers my question.
Very well. I am grateful to Dr. Morgan for bringing this matter to our notice, but I do not approve of the way in which he did it. If I may be blunt, he tried to force my hand.
How?
By going outside my organization, his organization, and thus showing a lack of loyalty. As a result of his maneuverings, there has been an adverse world court decision, which inevitably has provoked much unfavorable comment. In the circumstances, I have had no choice but to request, with the utmost regret, that he tender his resignation.
Thank you, Senator Collins. As always, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
You sweet liar, said Raja Singh as he switched off and took the call that had been flashing for the last minute.
Did you get it all?
Asked Sarath.
So that's the end of Dr. Vannevar Morgan.
Raja Singh looked thoughtfully at his old friend for a few seconds.
You were always fond of jumping to conclusions, Paul. How much would you care to bet?